Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We're starting at 9 during these days of the Senate impeachment trial. We'll have live NPR coverage of the trial at 10. This morning, we'll look at whether airlines will soon ban untrained emotional support animals. The federal government's proposing giving airlines that latitude. Certified and trained guide and support dogs would still be required to be accepted. We'll look at the pros and cons. Also, a few cities are trying novel ways to help prospective renters get into available units. But landlords aren't too happy. And we'll preview day 3 of the Senate impeachment trial. We'll get started on Air Talk right after the news.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us an hour earlier than typical. Looks like 9 o'clock is going to be our daily time slot as long as the Senate trial goes and as long as they start the day's proceedings at 10 o'clock Pacific time. We'll take you right up to NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage hosted by an array of NPR news personalities. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Also, tomorrow, Film Week will be preempted because of the Senate impeachment trial, but I'll be recording Film Week this afternoon. We'll have it loaded onto the Film Week page first thing tomorrow morning, so you'll be able to listen to it online. Wherever you get your podcast, Film Week will still be there, and it will be broadcast Sunday at noon here on KPCC, because there's no trial on Sunday. They do have it Saturday. That's why we're preempted Film Week Saturday also. But it'll be on the air Sunday at noon and available starting first thing tomorrow morning at kpcc.org. Just click on Film Week and the show is there. We begin today's program by talking about a proposed new federal rule which would give airlines latitude to be more restrictive in what are acceptable companion animals for air travel. With us, Los Angeles Times staff writer Hugo Martin, who covers the travel industry. Hugo, good morning. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So can you just briefly explain to us how this would allow airlines that want to rein in what's considered a service animal?
Yeah, basically, up to now, it's been very vague. The legislation that guides all this, the Air Carriers Access Act, is so vaguely written that different airlines have had different rules on what sort of animals you could bring on the plane with you as a service animal or as a emotional support animal. And the Department of Transportation has been hearing complaints from all sides. The loudest have been the flight attendants who are, you know, really worried about, you know, having dogs that are not trained, that don't behave on a plane. And so they've been complaining the loudest. And so the Department of Transportation yesterday finally came up with rules and said basically they're going to limit the definition of a service dog to a service animal to a dog. Any breed dog, as long as it's been trained and there's, you know, documentation to show that the dog is trained and can behave in a confined space.
I was seeing that the last year for which statistics are available, which is 2018, they averaged nearly 10 complaints a day. The airlines did collectively over service animals. So clearly it's been a big issue for the airlines.
Yeah, And the problem has been that people are able to get, you know, documentation off the internet or off of therapists who really are not doing, you know, a lot of testing on these animals, so that people could just bring their you know, household pets on a plane and claim them as service animals. And so you've had untrained dogs, and you've had rabbits and goats and pot-bellied pigs and the whole thing. And this menagerie on planes has led to a lot of problems, you know, not only complaints from passengers, but actual, flight attendants getting bitten and snapped at.
Or having to clean up messes. Hugo, what about the fares? Do people have to pay if they're bringing an animal into the cabin of the aircraft, just as they would have to pay if the animal was stowed in the cargo area?
Yeah, there are. Well, it varies by airline, but yeah, if it's under the new rules, only the service animal, which is a trained dog, will be allowed for free. Every other animal will be considered a pet, and will have to pay a fee, and will have to either be brought in a carrier if it's small enough, if it fits under the seat, or on the legroom area, like a small cat or a small rabbit or hamster, something like that, and a small carrier can be brought in the cabin. Bigger animals must go into the cargo hold. And different airlines have different limitations on those sort of rules.
And I've always wondered how they deal with allergies for people who are allergic to dogs and cats. Do the airlines just try and move people away from someone who's brought a dog or cat if they have the allergy? Do you know how they deal with that?
Well, that's been one of the problems that has come up, is that you don't have a lot of advance warning if someone, brings a cat or a rabbit or something onto a plane and another passenger has severe allergies. That sort of thing may just sort of explode in the cabin, because there's been no advance warning to the other passengers that someone's bringing a cat. So, yeah, that's one of the problems that has risen by this, increased number of animals on planes.
I guess just travel with an EpiPen, I guess, if you have a serious allergy. We're talking with Hugo Martin, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Also with us, Douglas Kidd, executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers, a nonprofit organization. Mr. Kidd, thank you for being with us. Do you support this proposed federal guideline giving airlines this latitude?
In general, yes. There needs to be reform in this area, but there needs to be more than just what the FAA is, or DOT is proposing. Right now, it's a little different than what it used to be. Years ago, when the planes were half full and there weren't that many service animals, there usually wasn't a problem. Now the planes are full or nearly so. Everybody seems to be wanting to bring their animal on board the cabin with them. And not without cause, because the airlines cannot guarantee the safety or even safe arrival of any animal that's put in the cargo bay. There's been a number of cases where animals have been...
We'll let you get your phone there and turn that off. All right. You still there with us?
Still here.
Yeah, go. Okay.
Where animals have been, have died or been misdirected and so forth. So there needs to be something better done than what's doing right now. There needs to be dedicated space in the passenger cabin for service animals. It's absurd to our minds to think that any reasonable service animal can get beneath the seat in front of you, especially with the reduction of space between rows. There needs to be better filtration of the cabin air, and there needs to be an elimination of the fee for putting your animal in the cargo bay, because this has been a real incentive for people to try and bring their pet into the passenger cabin.
Because they don't have to pay for it if they do that?
Exactly.
Okay. And so if there was a separate area in the cabin for the animals, that would enable you to segregate the animals from the passengers. That would limit it. I would think, though, that putting all the animals together could create a noise problem on the plane.
Well, exactly so. And we concur with the FAA. The animals that are brought on board the plane have to be properly trained. You simply cannot bring an untrained animal on board the plane and endanger other people. I need to point out here, too, that allergies are a real concern, that people have died from allergic reactions, and sometimes one EpiPen or two EpiPens just is not enough. People can still die. So there needs to be a much more done in terms of keeping the cabin air clear. There needs to be much more done in informing passengers that, hey, if we're going to have, you know, what animals are on the plane, so that you don't get yourself into a situation that could potentially, you know, be very serious.
We're talking with Douglas Kidd, National Association of Airline Passengers. Also with us, caller Terry, who is president of the Amanda Rescue Organization, in calling from Studio City. Terry, thank you very much for being with us. What are your concerns about giving the airlines this latitude?
I think that the use of emotional support animals is a real issue for people, and I don't disagree with them being restricted to dogs because of the allergy situation with some of the other animals that is a higher problem. The issue right now is that there isn't anything besides the canine good citizen test, which is a behavioral test, out there for people to comply with. I think if the airlines were to agree on some sort of certification, and then that certification was available to be obtained by the owners, that's very reasonable. And I think an additional price for traveling with your animal, which is $100 for most in-cabin animals currently, there is a price for traveling with your animal under your seat. It isn't free. If it's emotional support, it's free. I don't think that is necessary.
Do you think, though, that there are people who are claiming their animal is emotional support so they don't have to pay that $100?
I think yes, I think that does exist. And I think that a letter from your therapist or doctor that's actually someone who's been treating you instead of somebody online, as the other gentleman mentioned, which is certainly available. And I know that the airline that I travel on the most, if you travel with your animal, your letter of emotional support does have to come from your primary physician. It can't come from flywithyourdogdoctor.com or something. It has to be your primary doctor. The Amanda Foundation owns and operates a veterinary hospital in Beverly Hills. We have a lot of clients who travel with their pets, and there have been horrible incidences over the years where animals put in the hold have died, because your animal in the hold is property under the law, and it's only worth a certain amount of money if it dies in the hold. So there's not a real big incentive if the airline thinks that they're going to save, you know, $100,000 on jet fuel to pay out with your a dog ends up freezing, you know. So there's a big concern with people who do not want to put their dogs in the hold.
Terry, joining us, president of the Amanda Rescue Organization. I'd like to hear from AirTalk listeners what you think of this proposal. It's out for a comment period, as typically happens with these proposed federal rules. It's a 60-day comment period. This was just announced yesterday by the U.S. Department of Transportation. Once again, in case you just joined us, it would allow airlines, wouldn't require them, but would allow airlines to stop accepting emotional support animals on planes. Only service dogs professionally trained to perform tasks or assist passengers with disabilities, including psychological or psychiatric conditions, would be allowed. So you would still have support dogs, but they would have to be certified. We just heard from Terry the challenge in that. What qualifies as that certification? We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says the main problem with support animals, including those in training, is authentication. How do you know the animal is really a support animal? I can go out and purchase off the internet support animal or support dog animal in training vests for my dog without having to prove my dog really is in training or trained. Again, you can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, and let us know. JF writes, while flying on a plane, I started to feel really sick. When I got up, I saw a cat was in a bag under my seat, and I'm extremely allergic to cats. JF, I share your allergy. Fortunately, I've never had that circumstance where I've had to fly next to a cat. I hope I never have that experience. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What is the best way to deal with this? Douglas Kidd of the National Association of Airline Passengers, any thoughts on how to better deal with the certification issue that Terry brings up?
Well, I think she raises a valid point. For many years, the Association of the Blind has had their Seeing Eye program, and they're responsible for, you know, really making service animals what they are today. There are people that train, and an animal can be trained to fly. But, again, you need a good trainer, and there is a need for a national certification of animals to say, okay, these animals have demonstrated that they are, they know what they're doing when they're flying, they behave themselves, and their owners also know how to prepare them for a flight.
All right. Julie writes on the page, Larry, if people want their pets on the plane, at least bathe the animal before bringing them aboard. Had a terrible cross-country flight, worried I was coming down with the flu, when in fact there was a dog in the seat in front of me. Didn't see the dog until we landed. If I'd known there was a dog near me, I would have taken an antihistamine. This dog was as unkempt as the owner's. Dog hair everywhere. That's Julie writing on the AirTalk page. 866-893-KPECC. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We can continue with some listener calls. When we come back from the program, we'll hear from a couple of folks what they think of these proposed new areas of latitude for airlines. Back in 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk, an hour earlier than typical because of our NPR live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial, which gets underway at 10 o'clock today. That's the scheduled start time of the trial each day. So that enables us to do an hour of Air Talk from 9 to 10 o'clock. We appreciate your joining us an hour earlier than typical. Right now, our focus on the Department of Transportation proposed new rule, now subject to the 60-day comment period, allowing airlines latitude to be more restrictive on what they accept as a service animal. Vincent in Chino Hills, I understand that your wife is blind and that she has a trained guide dog. What's been her and your experience traveling with the dog?
The dog itself has been good. A lot of airports are very supportive of that, but she has been hurt. Two previous guide dogs of hers have been attacked by pets that should not have been in the areas they were in.
Wow.
It you know, that can ruin a guide dog, and it can take years to get a guide dog.
After all the training that they have to undergo, that can at least partially undo it?
Uh-huh, yeah. They can become very traumatized, unwilling to work, stressed out in situations. They may focus more on a pet that's across the street and ignore the car that's coming right at them. They just become hyper-aware of what has attacked them before than their actual job, the service they are actually providing, unlike an emotional support animal.
Yeah. Vincent, I appreciate you sharing that. That's terrible experience. Thank you. Let's talk with Christopher in Westwood. You're on Air Talk. Christopher, your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I could foresee a few kind of challenges. I think they're, you know, trying to handle a very complex issue, which is being experienced both in employment and in housing, right? So the difference here is because assistance animal is such a broad category, but under the ADA, which is essentially what they're trying to align their definition with, the animal has to be trained. The issue becomes, the documentation portion that they're going to require. So under the ADA, you can't require documentation for a service animal because an individual has two options for a service animal. One, it's either trained for them, say like a guide dog for someone who's blind for an observable condition. For hidden conditions, such as a psychiatric one, you can train the animal yourself, right? And most clinicians, a doctor doesn't provide documentation for a service animal, and there's no agency that will provide documentation for you. So requiring it could potentially, you know, amount to a litigated issue for a lot of the transportation centers, same way it has for both housing and employment.
All right, Christopher, I appreciate it. Caleb, in Irvine, I understand you travel with an emotional support animal. You concerned about airlines cracking down on this?
Yeah, definitely. My name is Caleb, and I travel a lot with my profession. And I'd like to point out that a lot of disabilities are not visible. I'm often approached in the airport and asked what disability I have. So there's several concerns along with a HIPAA and ADA compliance. Also, who does this affect? It affects the most marginalized communities with having to pay for certification, for several fees, along with expensive airfares. This seems to be a very regressive policy, impacting the people that are most marginalized, people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, and people with disabilities and disabilities that aren't necessarily visible.
Caleb, do you think it's working well as it is now?
I think we need more data before we jump to conclusions on how big of a problem this is. It seems to be very reactionary, and I think we would need more data to see how big is this problem actually, or are we overreacting, and how much does the corporation of airlines play into this narrative?
There are statistics that are kept on complaints. Hugo Martin of the LA Times, you want to comment on that issue? Because I had thought that those stats were part of what was driving this.
Yeah, in fact, the Department of Transportation in their proposed regulations yesterday noted that the complaints about pets on planes have been going up steadily in the past 4 or 5 years, not only filed with the Department of Transportation, but also filed with the airlines. They've also noted that the incidents of dogs biting and snapping and urinating in a plane cabin have also been on the rise. So they point to those numbers as a sign that they needed to take this action.
All right. David writes on the page, air travelers have a right to a safe and allergy-free cabin. No to any animals in a crowded cabin except for true ADA-certified service animals. Some people are allergic to dogs. Let's talk with Andy in Irvine. You're on Air Talk.
Hi there. So, yeah, I used to be a flight attendant, and I'm letting you know right now, I feel that this is very strict that we should only have ADA service dogs. I've had a couple emotional support animals on my planes before. I had one incident where two of these dogs actually started a fight and started snarling and growling at another dog, and we had to take that passenger off the plane. Another one of my friends actually got pinned up against the door between the flight deck and the plane by a dog that was being very aggressive, and the owner could not handle it. It did not control it.
So what would you say to Caleb, who said, you know, he doesn't have a visual disability, he deals with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the animal is necessary for him to be able to travel for the work that he does? What would you say to him about the best way of dealing with his needs and concerns versus flight attendants and other passengers?
You know, I feel that if he really needs the dog, then it should be board certified, and that it should be certified as a service animal and not emotional support animal. I also agree with the gentleman from LA Times with the last comment that, yes, there has been a rise in emotional support animals, like he said, snarling or going to the bathroom on planes. I've had incidents where dogs have gone to the bathroom on the planes, and the owners do not clean up after that. And then we have to delay the flight, and we have to have the cleaners come on and clean it.
All right. I appreciate it, Andy. Thank you so much for sharing your professional experience as a flight attendant, Andy in Irvine. Want to thank our guest, Hugo Martin, LA Times staff writer. He covers the travel industry, always writing interesting pieces about the very latest, including this proposed Department of Transportation rule allowing airlines more latitude on what's considered a service animal. Douglas Kidd, executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers, joining us as well. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. A couple of cities are trying novel ways of making it easier for prospective renters to get into rental properties. As we all know, large cash-only security deposits can be a real barrier for lower-income renters getting into units. They have to do first month's rent along with security deposits. That's a big barrier. Another issue can be someone's criminal background. Even if she or he has served their time, it can be something that landlords use to deny people an opportunity to get into a rental unit. According to a recent piece in the publication The Hill, Cincinnati City Council members recently passed a law expanding how renters can put up a security deposit and not doing it just with cash. Joining us is breaking news reporter for The Hill, Marty Johnson. Marty, thank you very much for being with us. Explain to us what Cincinnati officials have set up in lieu of cash deposits.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Larry. So the bill was originally brought to the city council attention by P.G. Sittenfeld. He is one of the council members on the city council. And the bill does four things. It basically gives tenants, renters, like the renter, a choice, four options. The first option is if they have the means to do so, they can pay the security deposit, traditional security deposit, as people have been doing for a long time. They can also request to have that security deposit that the landlord requests of them be spaced out over no less than six equal monthly payments. The bill also gives landlords the option to say, you know what, I still do want security deposit up front, but that security deposit can be no more than half of a month's rent, so it's reduced. And then the fourth option and the most innovative option that there is the security deposit insurance, which instead of paying a large sum of money up front, tenants would pay an insurance company that would insure the landlords, so they pay a low monthly non-refundable rate, and then they would every single month that they're in that property instead of paying the money up front.
And there are insurers, companies that offer that?
Yeah, so it's a pretty new space. That's a new space. The first big startup was by Rhino, and they were based out of New York originally, and they partnered with a bunch of different of New York City's largest real estate companies, okay, management companies. So they, you know, starting in late 2018, they had made over a catalog over 100,000 housing options for tenants to look at.
I would think one of the challenges, though, is an insurance company is going to want to know what's the rental history of someone for how they treated a unit, right? So, or are they just writing the policies without that knowledge?
So I think it's important to separate the new business, so the insurance deposit and like the renter's choice bill a little bit, because the bill does state that if any like major damage comes to the property that the tenant is in, then the landlord is subject to charge them for whatever that is. If it's an exorbitant amount, if any like irreparable damage comes to the unit, it doesn't protect tenants from going and doing whatever they want and knocking down the walls in their apartment. But it does give them the ability to move around, that flexibility to say, hey, I don't want to pay the security deposit up front or I can't. It gives them that flexibility.
We're talking with Marty Johnson, breaking news reporter for The Hill. Marty, thank you very much. Appreciate your talking about what's happening in Cincinnati. I'd like to hear from you as an AirTalk listener, if you are someone who thinks this would be a good idea, instead of requiring the large security deposits that are typical for rentals for people to get into units, or if you're someone who is a property owner and you have rental property, is this something that you wouldn't support, you think would potentially put your property at risk? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Also with us is Marisa Kendall, housing reporter for the Bay Area News Group up in the San Francisco, Oakland area. And she's going to tell us about what Oakland has done. Its city council this week moved to approve an ordinance prohibiting landlords from asking about a prospective tenant's criminal history or rejecting them as a result of a criminal history. Marisa, thank you for being with us. I understand Berkeley's also looking at this.
Yeah, the Berkeley City Council is set to vote on a similar ordinance next month. And then the activists that have been pushing for this are then going to turn their sights to Emeryville and Alameda County. So this really might be spreading.
Though, would landlords still be able to do financial background checks of prospective tenants?
Yeah, they'd still be able to do credit checks, look at a tenant's employment, look at landlord references. The only thing that would be off the table in most circumstances would be the criminal background checks.
And if for some reason the landlord became aware of a criminal background and the landlord didn't want to take that person onto their property for liability or other concerns, what would keep that landlord from using another pretext justification for excluding the prospective renter?
Yeah, and that's the problem with a lot of these laws, right, is it would be very easy for them to just exclude the renter on another pretext. If somehow the renter or the city can prove that the landlord was discriminating against the tenant because of their criminal background, the city can fine the landlord $1,000 per violation, or the tenant can sue. But I do think it might be hard to prove in some circumstances.
And I know some landlords have expressed concern about potential liability if, for example, they rent a unit to someone who has a criminal violent past, and there was some incident that took place on the rental property with that tenant after the person moved in, that somehow the landlord might be liable. Is there any language, to your knowledge, in what the city council put in here that gives some sort of legal protection to the landlord in an instance like that?
You know, not that I'm aware of, actually, but yeah, a lot of landlord groups are expressing concerns about that. To me, the main concerns that they expressed had less to do with their own personal liability and more to do with the safety of the neighbors and the other tenants in the building. You know, for example, if you have someone who has a history of domestic violence convictions, they move into a new apartment building, maybe to be closer to a victim who had been trying to escape them. You know, that kind of thing. So trying to protect the safety of their other tenants.
Or if you had a tenant who had multiple convictions for dealing drugs, you might be concerned that the person would, you know, go back to that kind of business if they rented a unit for you. Sounds like you would not have the latitude to exclude someone if that person had been a drug dealer.
Exactly. But on the other side, the activists who support this ordinance are saying, you know, there's no proof that you'll be a bad tenant just because you have a criminal conviction. They also argue, you know, background checks are not 100% accurate. There's flaws in them. You know, you might come across a record that should have been expunged that was not. There are mistakes in there. So they point that out. But landlords still do have the opportunity to look at the sex offender registry, as long as they do it after they give a conditional offer to the tenant. They can then look at the sex offender registry and screen them out based on that after the fact.
All right. We're talking with the Bay Area News Group housing reporter, Marisa Kendall. Again, I'd like to hear from you what you think about what these two cities are doing. In Cincinnati, there are multiple alternatives to put putting up a cash security deposit for people who are going into rental properties, that to try and lessen the financial burden for someone getting into rental housing. And then we have what Oakland has passed and Berkeley is strongly considering, which is banning criminal background checks as a part of the process of getting into a rental property. We'll talk with John, who has an apartment building in Huntington Beach, hear what he has to say about this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back in 2 minutes.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. And in case you're scratching and saying, what's he doing on at this hour of the day? Well, it's because of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. NPR's live coverage starts at 10 o'clock, just 18 minutes away. We'll have it for you. And that's also the planning for tomorrow. We'll be on from 9 to 10 o'clock. And tomorrow for Film Week, we won't be able to schedule it on air either tomorrow or Saturday because the trial is both days. It will air Sunday at noon, but it's available, of course, as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. That's starting tomorrow morning, and we'll also have it on our Film Week page, kpecc.org. When you get up tomorrow morning, it'll be available for you to listen whenever you want using the app or streaming at kpecc.org. We're talking about a couple of experimental programs to help people get into rental properties and remove barriers. One has to do with alternative ways of putting up a security deposit instead of a big chunk of cash. The other is with banning criminal background checks of prospective tenants. Oakland's done it. Berkeley is considering it. Ebon writes on the page, half a month's rent. I know someone whose rental unit received tenant-caused damage that cost significantly more than the one-month security deposit to repair. The owner had to pay out of pocket for the amount over the deposit. Let's talk with John. John, I understand you own a building in Oakland. You live in Huntington Beach. What do you think about this?
No, this is John. The building is in Buena Park, and what do I think about this? The problem with the new landlord or tenant protection business is not the rate of rent increase. That's no problem. It's the, quote, just cause to ask somebody to move. When it's very obvious, no problem. But when the tenant is doing things that are annoying their neighbors, we'd like to be able to ask that tenant to move rather than have the two good neighbors on either side of them move just to get away from this obnoxious person.
So how do you use a deposit as the buffer then? If the laws become so restrictive, it's difficult to evict someone for being an inconsiderate neighbor, how does the deposit factor into that?
The deposit covers me for the 60 days minimum that I'm required before I can issue a notice to move. The deposit also makes people just more cooperative with their neighbors. When they know they have something to lose, they're more... they get along better with other people.
All right, John, I appreciate it. Eric in Pasadena, I understand you have a rental in Oakland. What do you think about this?
Well, it was my home, and I had to move down to Southern California for some family stuff. So we rented. My worry is about, I have a thin margin. I rely on the rent that I get to pay the mortgage. And I want to be able to properly vet a potential tenant, because if something does go wrong, I'm really in a hot seat. Unlike larger landlords or, you know, firms that do this kind of thing, they can absorb an empty unit, but I can't. I'm wondering if there's any kind of differentiation for the different scales of business.
Yeah. Marisa Candle, Bay Area News Group. Do you know if the law in Oakland makes a distinction?
It does. So there is an exemption if you are a landlord of a single family home, an in-law unit in a backyard, a duplex or a triplex, and you live in the building. That's exempt. Also, some government subsidized housing. Those are really the only two main exemptions there.
All right. Eric, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Josue in Simi Valley, good to have you with us. What do you think about these two projects?
Well, I'd like to add on the criminal background checks.
Yeah.
I think that for certain crimes, certain felonies should have a time period on them, especially for violent crimes. Those should have a longer time period that you can vet a person and to either keep them or allow them on your property. But for lesser crimes, especially drug convictions on marijuana, which are ridiculous, they should be they should have a shorter time period that is allowable for you to be able to move in, because what a lot of times happens is people don't they're struggling from coming out of prison, being reformed, being a trying to be better citizens, and so some landlords, not all, but some, a small amount, they use that as an excuse to just, you know, throw them out into the street or not let them
in the first place. Josue, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Lynn from Westwood says, I'm a landlord and I'm against reducing the liability of the tenant by reducing the security deposit. It takes 4 to 6 months just to get a tenant out of a place. At that point, it makes the security deposit insignificant. Laura in Newport Beach says, I'm a landlord and I support these ideas, especially an insurance policy in lieu of a security deposit. As a landlord, you need to be able to make the right judgment calls. I've taken 6 months of rent up front due to someone's poor financial history. Michael in Van Nuys says, I own property in the Bay Area. The more regulations you put on the industry, the more you discourage people from building, and we have an affordability housing crisis. Let me go back to Marisa Kendall, housing reporter, Bay Area News Group. Did that come up at all to your knowledge in the debate over this, that it might have a depressing effect on housing construction?
You know, it received such strong strong support from city council. There wasn't much debate during the council meeting. For example, it was passed 8-0 unanimous vote. But this is the debate that comes up all the time with these tenant regulations. On one hand, you have people who say we need things like rent control and these different regulations to protect tenants. On the other hand, you have people saying, well, that will actually depress construction and make landlords not want to rent and further exacerbate the housing crisis. So this is kind of the age-old clash here.
Thank you so much, Marisa. We appreciate your being with us. Marisa Kendall, housing reporter for the Bay Area News Group. That includes publications like the San Jose Mercury News. And our thanks to Marty Johnson, breaking news reporter for The Hill. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming right up, we'll preview day three of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Back in 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
In just 10 minutes, NPR's live coverage, gavel to gavel, the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump continues with day three. We have two experts to join us to talk about what the expectation is for today's arguments. Yesterday, there was a tremendous amount of over again, repetitive recitation of the arguments against the president. With us is Margaret Russell, professor, Santa Clara University School of Law. Professor Russell, great to have you back with us. You expect we're going to hear more of the same today?
Well, I think you're going to hear, since this is the schedule, you're going to hear more of the House manager's case against the president with a fair number of interruptions for, you know, motions, amendments, discussions, responses, et cetera.
All right. And so we continue with the prosecution case. At what point will the defense be offering its rebuttal?
I believe that is scheduled, since the time is divided evenly, that that is probably going to start on Friday.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And at this point, what do you see as the comparisons with the Clinton impeachment? To this point, is it similar or not?
Well, it has some similarities, in part because it's a very rare occasion to have an impeachment of a president, and now this is our second experience with it in our lifetimes, or in, you know, most people's lifetimes now who are paying attention now. And I think the important thing to remember, though, is that it's not like precedent that is discussed in making court decisions. In other words, it doesn't have to be exactly the same procedure as the Clinton impeachment. And so that, I think that's why you hear a lot of arguments back and forth about whether it is or isn't. But there's no judgment that can be pronounced on that, because it actually can be different from impeachment to impeachment. It's a very rare occurrence.
Today, the argument, abuse of power, the argument that the president engaged in that with the alleged quid pro quo with the Ukrainian president over release of security aid. What is the value in the length of time for these arguments to be made? Again, because I think for the listener, the arguments one is hearing are so redundant. Is there particular value in taking all this time to make the case?
Well, I actually don't think they're redundant, and I think that this isn't too much time. I mean, it's chosen in part for partisan reasons, right? The 24 hours divided so that people have their chances. But let's remember how important this is. It is a rare occurrence. And I think it's really the process that is on trial as well, that is as open and transparent a process that we can have for the American people, particularly voters, to see what our government is doing and if they can step away from partisan roles. I think that's really important. So it's not too much time, and I think so far the time is actually being used with a lot of substance.
We're talking with Santa Clara University Professor of Law, Margaret Russell. Also with us, partner at the firm Baker Hostetler, David Rifkin. He's held positions in the Department of Justice and in the Office of White House Counsel. Elsewhere in the federal government, he's served largely in Republican administrations. Mr. Rifkin, thank you very much for being with us. What do you anticipate we'll hear today?
More of the same. I would gently disagree with Margaret, and we're not talking about the substance here. We're really talking about sort of a art of oral advocacy. I'm an appellate lawyer. I'm used to, you know, 20-minute, half-an-hour tops oral arguments. I watch portions of Mr. Schiff's presentation. I would say if I were supporting his position, which I'm not, I would have urged him to have a crisp, much shorter presentation. As you pointed out, he's been redundant. I thought his visual aids were kind of boring. I don't think he's carrying even the TV audience, not to mention the senators. So and look, it really does not need 12 hours spread over 3 days to make the case. The House case, underlined both articles, I think is entirely specious. I've said it before, I've written about it before, but irrespective of this, the factual evidence that they put forward is sparse, and all the endless, and look, I'm a constitutionalist, I practice constitutional law, it's the love of my life, but I wouldn't have had hours of endless repetitive quotes from the framers. It just doesn't get you anywhere. In terms of our moral advocacy, so I don't think it's particularly impressive.
When we hear from the president's counsel, one would anticipate they're going to argue that the president didn't do anything wrong in either he or his team's engagement with Ukrainian officials. Do you think that that's the right approach to take, or would it be better for his team to cede that the president shouldn't have raised the issue of the investigations of the Bidens in his contacts, but that it doesn't rise to the level of what a president should be impeached for?
Well, look, I think they're going to do some of both. My personal view, and you heard me say this before, and as I said, I've written about it on four different occasions for Wall Street Journal in the last 3 months. What the president is accused of doing by the Democrats does not rise, as a matter of constitutional law, to the high crime and misdemeanor, and therefore is not impeachable. And to crystallize it very simply is because he was exercising the core foreign affairs powers of his office. In doing so, there can be only two circumstances where he can commit a high crime and misdemeanor. One, that he violated some statutory law, which he did not, or he's done something that violates some specific constitutional commands, like withdraw money from Treasury not a consequence of appropriations, or suspend habeas corpus, as President Lincoln did in the early, without congressional authorization in early stages of Civil War, or, for example, refuse to faithfully execute a given statute in its entirety, which is called a suspension power of the Constitution.
Okay. So you disagree with the Governmental Accountability Office's analysis of this, which found that his withholding the money violated the law.
I disagree with it, but it's not even important. What's important, if you actually look at the statute, first of all, numerous presidents have used flexibility in dispensing the money appropriated by Congress, provided the money was dispensed in the same fiscal year.
Okay. All right. I need you to hold that point because I'm almost out of time. Margaret Russell, Santa Clara University, your response to Mr. Rifkin.
Well, listen, I'm an educator and a constitutional law professor, and I'm not going to spend my time telling people what to conclude. I think that this is a constitutionally mandated process. It deserves all the time that it needs with evidence and witnesses, and that the people who benefit from this in the Constitution are the people who've elected these representatives. So I would urge people not to be dismissive, not to be sort of short attention span about it. You can turn it on and off, but the point is this is a historic process set forth in the Constitution, and it is people deserve to hear the arguments and decide for themselves. I'm not going to just take one side and say, oh, just listen to me. No, this is for everyone.
Margaret Russell, thank you for being with us again. She's professor of law, Santa Clara University. And David Rifkin of the firm Baker Hostetler, he served in a number of Republican administrations, the Office of White House Counsel, as well as the Department of Justice. Stay tuned. NPR's live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial continues in seconds. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for an early full hour of Air Talk on KPCC.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.